Let me play among the stars, and let me see what spring is like on a Jupiter and Mars. In other words, hold my hand.
Hello, everybody. My name is Baratha the Hutt, and my co-host is Sandy the Girl Cat. Today is Friday, July 19, 2019, and we are on the cusp of the 50th anniversary of the first landing on the moon by human beings, specifically the US of A. I would like to let you all know that Brothatan the Science Man decided to take over this week's podcast because we had a very special guest. I will not spoil it for you, and I'll let Brothatan the Science Man speak to you more about it. But just a quick interlude before we switch on over, I just want to thank all of our listeners out there. Sandy's definitely very appreciative, and I and Brothatan the Science Man are also very humbled that we have listeners in the country where we are invited into your homes, into your phones, into your cars, and into your computers. So, without further ado, I'll switch it over to Baratheon the Science Man and his wonderful interview with a wonderful gentleman named Tom Sanzone. Baratheon the Science Man here, just to let you know that the scene you heard in the beginning was not Baratha the Hutt. It was me, Baratheon the Science Man. I just wanted to make sure that I received credit for that. Anyway, without further ado, I would like to introduce you all to a pre-recorded interview with a gentleman named Tom Sanzone. Tom Sanzone is a wonderful friend of mine, and we were introduced to each other at my alma mater, Villanova University. Tom will introduce himself a little bit more, but the reason why I decided to interview Tom was because he worked with NASA back in the late 60s and specifically played a big hand in the Apollo 11 mission, as well as all the other Apollo missions and the space shuttle missions as well. He worked at NASA for 40 years before retiring in 2011. 40 plus years, I should say. And he is a wonderful fellow. Just to let you know ahead of time, we spoke a lot about Villanova, Villanova basketball, and other random topics. So we shall skip through all of that and go right to the meat of the interview. Tom, I know that you worked for NASA for a very long time. And this is just for our podcasters to know as well. So, Tom, if you could just introduce yourself. I didn't tell the podcasters anything at all before we started. So,
okay. All right. So you want me to give a little background?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So I am a proud graduate of Villanova University, as are you. I graduated in 1968 with a degree in electrical engineering. My dream kind of was to join a company where I could be a field service rep and go all over the world. And so I joined Hamilton Standard, was the name of the company back then, and it was a division of United Aircraft Corporation. The corporate name changed a few years later to United Technologies Corporation.
And that's okay.
That's what it is now. The reason it changed, by the way, is United Aircraft was all aircraft type companies. Sikorsky Helicopter, Hamilton Standard made controls and propellers, made radar. And so the corporation rode the waves of the economic issues. And so the chairman of the board, a guy by the name of Harry Gray, in the early 70s said, we need to diversify to smooth out this curve, this sine wave. And so he went out and he bought Otis Elevator and he bought Carrier Air Conditioning. And then they weren't very much aircraft companies, so he changed the name from United Aircraft to United Technologies. So anyway, when I was interviewed, I was supposed to be assigned to the Boeing facility in Seattle because they were building the Hamilton Standard did space, and that's what we're going to talk about. But it was a very small piece of the business. The larger piece of the business, the much larger piece of the business, was subsystems for airplanes.
Okay, mainly commercial.
Military, but primarily commercial.
Okay,
that you'd recognize. So. Cabin pressurization, air conditioning, engine starters, things that you don't really think that much about. And I think they make, like for some of Boeing's planes, probably a dozen or more subsystems. And nowadays they try to integrate these subsystems and sell a bigger package so that they can take advantage of all the integration. So in any case, Boeing was building a brand new plane in 1968. It was called the 747.
Ah, yes.
And it was the biggest commercial plane ever built. And I remember going down into our shop and seeing the piping that was going to go into the wings.
Oh, wow.
And it blew me away to see the diameter of this piping. You know, I couldn't really picture the size of the plane. So one of the things that Hamilton made was fuel controls for jet engines. They're like carburetors for jet engines. Excuse me. And so that was one of the things that I was going to be asked to work on, being one of several reps at the Boeing headquarters facility in Seattle. The day I showed up for work, May 27th, 1968, a gentleman met me in the lobby who had taken me to lunch when I had interviewed. So I interviewed with somebody else, but This person took me to lunch, and I really hit it off with that person, and I didn't hit it off so much with the guy who interviewed me. As a matter of fact, I was surprised that I got the offer of employment.
Oh, okay.
So he met me in the lobby and of the of the company, and he said, since you were here in February, I have been promoted to be the service manager for the space systems department. And one of the things you do in field service departments is it's somewhat like the military. You go where they send you, and you're there a year or two, and they send you someplace else. And that's what I was looking for, actually. So he said, you're not going to Seattle. You're going to work for me, and you're not going to Seattle. You're going to go to Houston, to the NASA Space Center, for a year or a year and a half.
Okay.
Wow. And 53 years later, I retired as general manager of our Houston office. So that's what got me to Houston. And the product that got me to Houston was officially called the Portable Life Support System. A lot of people call it the backpack that the astronauts wore on the moon when they moonwalks. So I always smile at this because within about 2 to 3 months, they turned me into a mechanical engineer, and I never changed a light bulb after that. And ironically, I started in mechanical engineering, but you know, as a freshman, you don't really have a major. You just have an idea of what you're going to do.
Right.
And I had one mechanical engineering course, and I wasn't enamored with the professors, and all I could think of was I can't do another 3 years with these people. And of course, I was probably too shy to go talk to an advisor. So I just made this decision on my own that I was going to switch to electrical engineering, which in some respects was a mistake, but made it through, got my degree, and then they turned me into a mechanical engineer at NASA because the life support system, the portable life support system, we call it the PLIS because everything at NASA has an acronym. Even right. NASA is an acronym, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So the backpack is primarily hydropneumatic. The only electrical stuff it really had was a radio. And the radio that we had when I first got there really wasn't a great one. I'll be kind. I won't mention the supplier.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so it actually worked so poorly that NASA told Hamilton Standard, look, we're going to go procure a radio and provide it. The term is government-furnished equipment. So they issue a separate contract. They have this radio built. It was built by RCA. That's the radio that was used on the moon for all the lunar missions.
Okay.
And it worked. It worked quite well. So we had that. When I first got there, we were responsible for the radio. And so I had to, you know, test the radio, et cetera, et cetera. And then the only other thing we had were, it was kind of before transistors were really doing their thing. You know, I had it in school, but they weren't yet making stuff. So we had these terminal boards, you know, wire, all kinds of wires that were soldered to terminal junctions.
Oh, and goodness
ironically,
gracious.
Yeah. Ironically, the biggest problem we had was a mechanical problem. And that was what were called cold solder joints, where you put a wire on a terminal, solder it, but the wire is not in contact with the terminal. You know, it's like loose.
Mm-hmm.
And that was our biggest headache. We were constantly, you know, fixing these, quote, cold solder joints. And then because they were going to fly in space and there were a lot of vibration on launch, each time we would do this, we'd have to conformally coat all the wiring and that, which made it a total mess when you tried to clear it out. So anyway, those were the only two electrical things I did for a relatively short period of time. So one day my boss, my supervisor, came to me, and the way NASA worked then, at least, was you just help. Apollo was an intense program because we were trying to get to the moon by the end of 69.
Yep.
And nobody sat on the sidelines because that's not my job, you know. Mm-hmm. Everybody felt everything was their job, so you were available to do anything. So my boss came to me and he asked me to run a test. That I remember it. The test was, what procedure should we use to charge up the oxygen tank? So our oxygen tank was charged to about, at that time, about 1,000 pounds per square inch. And so when you recharge it in the spacecraft, you know, you had kind of an impulse which created heat. And
yes.
The tank would get fairly hot. And then when it cooled off, the pressure would drop. And so you'd have to top it off. And so the test was to determine how long should we wait before we top it off, and then how long should we keep the oxygen supply connected, and had to come up with this optimized procedure that we would ask the astronauts to do. So I ran that test, and so he later said to me, I think he gave me another test to run, mechanical test. And he said, you seem to enjoy these mechanical tests more than the electrical stuff, which was a very good assessment. And I said, yeah, I do. And that was it. I was never an electrical engineer again, except in degree. So I have to laugh because, you know, I got a professional achievement award in 2013 from Villanova in the Department of Electrical Engineering. And I was almost embarrassed to tell Dr. Singh that I'm not sure I could change a light bulb up, you know, but anyway, that's the way it worked.
Oh, wow.
So I was in a group, relatively small group of what we call test engineers. So we had one group of engineers that, and I don't want this to sound like it's going to sound, but they handled all the paperwork, engineering changes and stuff like that.
Yes, yes.
The test engineering group, we did hands-on testing. I mean, it was sort of where the action was.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It was great experience, exposure, phenomenal amount of teamwork, and very enjoyable to do. So what we would do, the life support systems, the portable life support systems, were manufactured at our headquarters in Windsor Locks, Connecticut, and then they were sent to us as in Houston as a finished product. Put finished in quotes. As a finished product, and then we would test it. If there were issues or failures of components, we'd have to change those components out. We'd have to do failure analysis. We would have to service them for training and vacuum chambers. Then we'd test them again, and then we'd ship them to Kennedy Space Center for fit checks, and then they would test it at Kennedy Space Center, and then they would send it back to us, and then they would test, we would test it again. So there was a lot of testing that went on. The other thing that we did then, which I ended up doing a lot of and very much enjoyed, was, excuse me, and NASA doesn't do it this way today. They have a separate group that handles all the training of the astronauts. But back in those days, our test engineers, who actually knew the hardware extremely well, also did the training of the astronauts with the, what we call flight hardware. And so our heat exchanger would only work in a vacuum. So we would train them. They had what we refer to as 1G training, where they used a quote backpack that was really a box, and we hooked it up cryogenic air, you know, to provide cooling and stuff. It had none of the guts of the actual life support system they were on the moon, but that system was used in the vacuum chamber. So my boss came to me at one point. I had a great boss, as you could tell. He came to me and he said, okay, I want you to handle the training of, I want you to run this next chamber run, vacuum chamber run. And I said, okay. And, you know, you need to sit on the console and you're the guy responsible and you talk to crew through the procedures. And we would, you know, simulate failures and things like that. And I'll take a quick aside. What we like to say about the spacesuit slash life support system is it's not a big garment. It's a small spacecraft. And if you
really
think, yeah, because when you think about what you have when they go out, now I'm thinking space shuttle, but same thing on the moon. You go out on the moon, you everything you need is in that life support system in that spacesuit, right? There is no spacecraft. There's no umbilicals that you're hooked up to while you're out doing a spacewalk or walking on the moon. So it helps people understand the complexity of the portable life support system. So we would stick them in a chamber and we would simulate all these failures, you know, shut off the fan and, you know, you'll hear the warning sound, and et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So anyway, the first crew I got to train was the Apollo 11 crew. I was 22 years old.
Apollo 11 crew.
Yeah. And I didn't really have an appreciation for it at the time because it was just like next man up in a game, you know? Okay, here's your task. You got to go do this crew. And then later I thought about it and I thought a lot of guys had spent their careers up to that point, you know, working on this hardware, et cetera, et cetera. And here I am, this freshman that shows up and somebody gives me a uniform and says, here, put this uniform on and go in the game. You know, it's like, oh my gosh. So, I did. And then what happened after that was I really became kind of the lead trainer for the Apollo astronauts. So I trained all the lunar crews except the Apollo 12 crew. So Apollo 12 was relatively close to Apollo 11 because, you know, if we didn't make it on Apollo 11, Apollo 12 was our last shot. So someone else was assigned to that crew because you have to prepare for quite a while for these runs. So it's a long answer to what I did. This is what I did back in the Apollo days. And then later for Space Shuttle, I became the engineering manager in Houston for for the extravehicular mobility unit. That's what we call a spacesuit at NASA, not a spacesuit. Call it an extravehicular mobility unit, EMU. Okay. And then in 2006, that great boss I had for 17 years decided to leave. And I became the general manager. I took over his job. I became the general manager of our Houston office. And then that was 1986. And then I got stuck in that one. I shouldn't say stuck. I loved my job. And I stayed as general manager till 2011 when I retired.
Wow.
Long
amazing
answer.
Story.
Yeah, sorry.
Do you want to know where I was in 2011?
I have to, you're class of 2016, right?
Yep.
So, Yeah, you were a twinkle in somebody's eye, maybe.
Oh, definitely starting senior year of high school.
Okay.
In the fall of 2011, yeah, so.
Oh, when I retired, I thought.
Yes,
you meant.
When you were, no, but yeah, back yeah, in 2011.
When I left.
Yep.
Yeah, no, I can relate to it. I was in South Africa for 4.5 weeks, just got back a few days ago, and I spoke at three different school groups at two different schools.
That's a lot.
Well, it was a lot of fun. And what I found was I was amazed at how interested the kids were. I spoke to a high school. I spoke to the upper half of a primary school and then the lower half of the primary school. So through grade three.
Yep.
And the principal, as she was introducing me, she said, "Who knows who was the first man on the moon?" And I mean, half the kids just blurted out Neil Armstrong. And then she said, "Who knows what he said when he stepped onto the moon?"
Mm-hmm.
And this third grader raised his hand in South Africa and said, "That's one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind." And I mean, a third grader in South Africa. So one of the things that I learned was, talking about technology, this kind of blew me away, to be honest with you. They didn't have television in South Africa
mm-hmm.
in 1969. So they listened on the radio.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I had no idea that was the case. They didn't get TV till like 73, 74, something like that. About the same time, well, we actually had color TV before that. But yeah, so yeah, long answer to your question.
Oh, no, this is absolutely amazing. Thank you so much for sharing with me. Before this conversation, all I knew was that you're a very popular Villanova guy back on campus as well as off campus. You are actually known nationally and now internationally. and that, yeah, you've the energy, the excitement that you get from working with astronauts as well as your fellow peers, that definitely shows up a lot. And some the times of which we worked together in Citizens for Space Exploration, so I didn't get too much of your background until now, so this is just oh my goodness, Tom, you're everywhere.
You know that we're recording this on July 17th and I still live like half a mile from the Johnson Space Center. So there's a lot of activities going on every single day. I came from one just 15 minutes before we started speaking, and there's another one tomorrow that I'm actually very much looking forward to. It's a memorabilia exhibit put on by the people who are still around here that worked on Apollo 11. And so I spent about an hour and a half earlier today collecting a bunch of stuff that I thought might be interesting tomorrow. So it's from 4:30 to 6:30, and then we're going to go across to the park and drink beer after 6:30. So it's kind of a throwback to the way Apollo was back in the day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and then we have a big big gala dinner on Sunday night, actually the 21st, the day after the moon landing anniversary, that is primarily for people who worked in mission control during Apollo, and particularly Apollo 11. But there were a lot of people. One of the things that I often tell people is that room that you see on TV, the flight control room, there are, I don't know, 15 flight controllers in there. You know, that's it. But that's the tip of the iceberg, and all around the outside of that control room are backup rooms, support rooms. Yeah, and so there's including spouses, there's 630 people going to this gala, and they limited it to that. But I'll tell you one other thing that is always of interest to people. So I have to ask you, your class of 2016, so you're about 25 now?
Yes, 25.
25. The average age of a flight controller on Apollo 11, when we landed on the moon,
mm-hmm.
26.
Holy moly.
I know. That blows people's minds. Oh. I will tell you why, at least my theory of why. And that was space really didn't get started. NASA is about 60 years old. Mm-hmm. It got started in the late 50s when the Russians launched Sputnik, their satellite called Sputnik. Yep. And it started orbiting the Earth and beeping, and it kind of spooked a lot of Americans, and it definitely spooked politicians that this satellite was going around.
Mm-hmm.
So the predecessor of NASA, NASA, was NACA, National Something Committee on Aerospace or something like that. And then that morphed, this was under President Eisenhower, and then that morphed into NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So Kennedy made his speech. I did some reading up on this for my, when I talked in South Africa. So I'm actually more than I was 2 weeks ago. Kennedy made his speech to Congress in May of 1961 when he said, I think this country should land a man on the moon before the decade is out and return him safely to the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
It was primarily a political move. I've learned relatively recently that Kennedy didn't really care that much about space. But what he cared about was changing the attitude of Americans who felt that they were trailing the Soviet Union in technology, not just space, but technology, particularly space. And there, we were in a Cold War. And one of the other pieces of data that I'll give you is the United States funded NASA as if it were a war. So NASA, at its peak of Apollo, NASA received 4.5% of the federal budget. Today, it is 1/10 that. Okay, so you can see the change. So people say, why can't we go back to the moon quicker and all that? And it's largely driven by money. You know, money drives technology. You know, research and all those kinds of things.
Especially the forefront of technology.
Like absolutely. Absolutely. I heard a thing on the radio today. I tried to verify it online, but it said the memory in the Apollo spacecraft computer would hold 2,056 words. And then in the process of trying to verify this, I found an article online, and it said an iPhone 5S has 1,500 times the computing power of the Apollo spacecraft landing computer.
So it was I can believe that.
And so a lot of that computing power was driven by NASA. You know, cell phones never would have been developed as quickly as they were without NASA's need for miniaturization of the spacecraft. So there's a lot of stuff that came out of Apollo and then future programs.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, time to rope you in a little bit.
Okay. I understand.
And on to our next question, and still concerning specifically Apollo 11. Where were you when the astronauts landed on the moon? So you did talk about training the astronauts. The question now becomes, where were you? Who was around you when Apollo 11 landed on the moon?
Okay. So there's two questions I'm going to answer. One is, where was I when they landed on the moon?
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, where was I when they walked on the moon?
Okay.
It's
yep.
a different, yep. different answer. So what a lot of people don't realize is the flight plan called for, believe it or not, the flight plan called for the astronauts to go to sleep after they landed on the moon because they had a long day.
Oh.
And NASA wanted them to rest before they went out onto the moon. And we all looked at each other like, are you kidding? Who can sleep on the moon? I mean, there's no, I mean, can you imagine? Okay, I'm going to take, we're the first two people to land on the moon. Now we're going to go to sleep and take a nap. Mm-hmm. So there were very few of us that thought that that plan would hold real time. But what happened was, because I was part of a support team that had to monitor the data and all that, we all got sent home to go to sleep. Because we were supposed to be sleeping in parallel with the crew so that when we came in, whatever it was, 6 hours later or whatever, we would be fresh. Mm-hmm. So guess how many of us went home and didn't turn the TV on to watch the landing on the moon? And so I watched the landing on the moon from my little, heck, the thing had to be a 12-inch screen in my apartment by myself when they landed on the moon. We watched Cronkite. Everybody watched Walter Cronkite. Shortly after they landed on the moon, I got what was not an unexpected phone call. Mm-hmm. And it said, NASA's decided that they're not going to sleep. And so get in here as quickly as you can. And, you know, we're going to do our thing. They're going to go out much earlier than it was in the flight plan. So I talked earlier about backup rooms all around Mission Control. Well, there's one room that's called the Mission Evaluation Room. I won't go into all the others, but there's one room that's called the Mission Evaluation Room. Today, it is actually housed inside of Mission Control, not the front room that you see, but one of the bigger, probably the biggest back room. Back then, it was actually in a building across the parking lot from the Mission Control building, but obviously we're all connected. The Mission Evaluation Room was staffed primarily by engineers who had worked with the hardware and really knew the hardware intimately. So flight controllers are very well trained, but to a certain point. And then once you get past that point, you know, they know procedurally what to do, failure modes, what action to take, those kinds of things. But the way I've always described it is when you get down to open the fan guts up and tell me where the red wire should go and where the blue wire should go, mm-hmm. that went to the Mission Evaluation Room. So we had all the drawings. We had contact with the manufacturers of the hardware. We could get information very quickly. So one of the things that I did that night, we didn't have any serious technical issues. But one of the things that we did, and I'm smiling as a 2016 graduate, this is going to blow you away. The data came, we had about a dozen channels of telemetry. Things like suit pressure, temperatures, oxygen tank pressure, heat exchanger temperatures, things mm-hmm. like battery current voltage, all that stuff would come down from the moon. But it came down in digital format. So you'd see data on a screen and everything was abbreviated and, you know, you'd see like BCUR for battery current. And it would show you the battery current, you know, 2.1 amps. But as good engineers, you don't look at data in spots. You look at trends in the data. That's what tells you your performance is correct. And so what we did was, believe it or not, hand plotted the data on graph paper, 11 by 17 graph paper. I laugh to say it. This was the slide rule age. Have you ever seen a slide rule?
I actually have. I tried to buy one online, but they're actually all expensive.
Yes, I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are. I have one on my shelf right over here, and on the inside flap it says 136 Sullivan. In case it was lost, that was my room. So we plotted the data. I had two sheets on Armstrong, and there was another engineer that had two sheets on Armstrong. And between the two of us, we covered, you know, 12 pieces of data. Mm-hmm. And then there were two other guys that did the same for Aldrin. Before the mission, what we would do is we would take what was then called magic marker. Today, it's called a highlighter. And we would highlight on the graph paper where we expected the data to fall. It's the same thing that's done today with computers, but we did it manually. And so as we were plotting our little dots across the page, if the dot fell outside the highlight, it put up a red flag and you'd say, we need somebody to take a look at this. You know, what do you think's going on if the current started climbing or something like that, or the suit pressure was dropping and we didn't know why, or the oxygen tank pressure was dropping at a rate faster than we expected, things like that. And, you know, we'd kind of wave the flag and say, hey, somebody needs to take a look at this. But the performance of the hardware was, you know, just fantastic. It was really good through the whole Apollo program. We had a backup oxygen system charged to 6,000 PSI. A lot of people thought of it as a bomb. We never had to use it. Never had to use it on all those missions, thank goodness. So it was, I'll tell you one last related story. I saw Neil Armstrong, ran into him maybe 4 or 5 times after Apollo 11 over the years. You know, he left NASA, he went to teach at the University of Cincinnati, et cetera, and I would run into him at something, and I'd be the first to tell you that, you know, he's not going to remember me, but I would say, I was your PLIS engineer. And then there was an instant connection, you know. He might not remember me, but he remembered he had a PLIS engineer. And if I told him it was me, it was probably true. So the last time I saw him, I was invited to an event that ended up being extremely special. I didn't expect it to be. The Lunar Receiving Lab, which is where the astronauts went into after the first couple of missions when they came back, because they were worried about moon bugs. So they wore these biological garments, and then they were kept in isolation for, I think, 3 weeks. Obviously, there ended up being no moon bugs, and they didn't do that later. But they ended up dedicating the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. This was in 2010, and I was invited because I had worked with the crew, but I expected a large crowd, and it turned out there were only 35 people there, including 3 who walked on the moon, Armstrong, Aldrin, and the 12th man to step on the moon. He's not considered the last man on the moon because his commander was the last one to leave the moon, Gene Cernan, but Jack Schmidt was his name, and he was there as well. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a punch and cake type event. And I ended up sitting across this table from Armstrong, just sort of luck of the draw. And so we were talking, and I told him I was his PLIS engineer. And he said, that thing really worked great, you know, et cetera. He was very complimentary. And I remember saying to him, well, I read all the debriefings and all the reports, and I knew the performance was good, and I had heard that you were very satisfied, et cetera. But it's pretty cool hearing it directly from you. And so that was the last time I was with him. That was June of 2010. And then I think in August of 2012, he passed away.
Mm-hmm. Wow, beautiful story.
Yeah.
Any beautiful stories like that with Buzz?
I really don't. Sometimes I was asked just today by an older Villanova alum, how was Buzz to work with? And Armstrong was noted for being very cool, calm, collective. Sometimes people would describe him almost as shy. Mm-hmm. He was a very, very smart guy. He just wasn't particularly ebullient. Aldrin, and I know this more from the future than I did when I first worked with him. You know, he's out there all the time now. So they were very different people, but I never had any issue, you know, working with him at all. So,
okay, I definitely do remember seeing a very random video recently while I was just looking up stories and histories I saw a random video of Buzz Aldrin punching
someone
in the face.
Somebody was talking about the conspiracy theory, right?
Right.
I think so. By the way, I got asked that question twice in South Africa by kids.
Oh.
Conspiracy theory. So I will give you the answer I gave to the kids and the faculty members. I said, the best answer I ever heard, the best simple answer I ever heard. So nobody at NASA, nobody's worked at NASA believes in the conspiracy theory because, you know, we're all there.
Right.
But the best answer I ever heard came from Charlie Duke. Charlie Duke later walked on the moon on Apollo 16 as the lunar module pilot. But in my mind, he's almost as famous for being the capsule communicator, what we call the CAPCOM, in mission control when they landed on the moon. The CAPCOM back then was always an astronaut. Spoke their lingo. He was generally the only person that talked to the crew. All flight controllers in that room are talking to the flight director, and they're making an agreement on what's going to get passed up to the crew, and then the capsule communicator sends it up. So Charlie Duke was the capsule communicator when they landed on the moon. Mm-hmm. So he was the first human to speak to somebody sitting on another celestial body. And I can still remember what he said, almost word for word. Armstrong said, the eagle has landed.
Mm-hmm.
And Charlie Duke said, Roger, we copy you down, eagle. You got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Because everybody, they had 17 seconds of fuel left when they touched down.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to put a plug in for a film for both you and your listeners.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
The film Apollo 11, two films I'll give you. The film Apollo 11, easy to remember. That's the name of the film. One of the best, probably the best NASA film I've ever seen. They found, I believe it's 55 millimeter film in archives. It was very unusual for that 50 years ago. Then they put it through a process that makes it look like it was shot last week. And the film is a total documentary. And by total documentary, I mean there is no Hollywood input. You know, people gripe about Hollywood messing with things.
Right.
There's no Hollywood input. There is no narration at all.
Oh.
The only narration you hear is Walter Cronkite talking on newscasts 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. I got to see it in IMAX. If you ever have the opportunity to see it in IMAX, do it. The other film has been out since, I believe, 2016, and it is entitled Mission Control, I think the Hidden Heroes of Apollo or something like that. I have the DVD. I watched it when it first came out. It was made from a book. I knew one of the authors of the book who was a NASA chief flight director.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was flying back from South Africa, it was one of the videos. And even though I had seen it before, I started watching it. And it's really good, particularly this week. I mean, it's like recommended viewing if you really care about Apollo. And it's they're interviewing and talking to these actual flight controllers, you know, the guys that were there. And there's not a whole lot of them left, you know. So I'm in an organization where it's quote, old Apollo guys, you know, that worked in mission control. And the guy that is the moderator for the group and sends the emails out and all that, you don't get an email from them because 90% of the time it's here's who died.
Oh, wow.
It's like one a week on average because all these guys are up there. Even the youngest of the average is like 77. And then people like Gene Kranz, the very famous flight director, he's, I believe, 83 or 84. And then the original flight director, who was Chris Kraft, he's like 93. So in many respects, this is like the last hurrah for Apollo. You know, it really is. So it's somewhat bittersweet, but we're all enjoying it while we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish I was down there.
Ah,
Believe
yeah, jump on a plane. Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's stuff going on around the country, stuff going on in Washington. I don't know if you heard that they're projecting the Saturn V image onto the Washington Monument.
Oh
I
my
think.
goodness, that would be
Yeah,
so cool.
there's things going on in Huntsville, Alabama. A lot of people don't know that NASA actually has 10 centers around the country. It's Johnson Space Center gets most of the publicity because that's where the astronauts live and train most of their training. But there's centers in Greenbelt, Maryland, Kennedy Space Center, Alabama, Ohio, several in California, Houston. And there's stuff going on in all these different centers. There's a lot of celebrations and a lot of that kind of stuff going on. I don't know. You and I are Facebook friends, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
Okay. So check out what I've been posting this week, and
Yep.
I think you'll get a kick out of it. Maybe you
Definitely,
have. I guess
definitely.
you have.
I've checked some of it out,
Okay.
absolutely, earlier in the
Yeah.
week.
Okay.
Ford actually is also celebrating the anniversary as well
Yes, I'm going to
because.
put a plug in for you, or I let you do your own plug because I
Oh,
know what
okay.
you're going to say. Maybe
You
you're
actually
listening.
do?
Yes, Ford built the Mission Control Center.
They did and maintained it for a number of years.
That's right.
So,
Well, Ford Aerospace. I remember it well.
I don't because
Yeah, well, you weren't around,
I was
but
actually
yeah, Ford built the Mission Control Center.
I was
I
actually very
actually, I mean, I
surprised about
knew
that.
it, but I actually heard it on the radio today. I was in my car and listening, and on the news on the radio, it was a Houston station, and they were talking to somebody at Ford about that very thing. I guess Ford may have put out a press release, something to get a little publicity. I don't blame them for that. And so this particular announcer in Houston picked up on it and interviewed somebody back in Detroit, and he said what they did. And because it's a long time ago, so there's a lot more people that are younger than me than are older than me, so they don't, they would never know. They would never, and they wouldn't even guess that Ford Motor Company could have such a role in the space program.
Exactly.
But they did.
So.
Yeah, absolutely did. And one last thing relative to that is through private contributions, the what we call historic Mission Control Center in Houston. So we have real active control centers, like
Yep.
floor below and stuff like that for space station and all that are, going all the time. But we've had the historic Mission Control Center is actually a National Historic Landmark in the United States. And I used to be able to take people in there and walk, have them sit at consoles, have them sit at Gene France's console and stuff like that. I know that was the reaction from most people. And then the lady that runs the history office at NASA told me about 2 years ago, she said, "You're not going to be able to do that anymore. They're going to do a lot of refurbishment. They're going to lock the room. No more people on the floor. You just have to go to the what we call the viewing room. It's like a little movie theater just behind the control room with big glass, like maybe 5 rows of seats."
Okay.
But anyway, what they did was they totally brought it back to exactly what it looked like in 1969. So all the lights work. The lights haven't worked in years and years. Lights work. There are now ashtrays on the console desks. Packs of cigarettes from the era. Soda cans from the era.
Holy moly.
I haven't seen it yet. I'm hoping to see it on Monday morning. But people that I know that have gone in there said it's amazing. It's part of the Space Center Houston tour. Space Center Houston is the visitor center, the official visitor center for the
Okay.
Johnson Space Center. So you can go there and it's $25 or $30 to enter, but you can take a tram, and one of the places that they take you is the historic Mission Control. So it's actually been closed for a couple of years, but just reopened like a month ago.
For all of those renovations.
Yeah, the whole thing was
Yeah.
targeted on the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, and they raised $5 million to do
Oh my.
non-taxpayer funded. The city of Webster, which is one of the local towns near NASA. Houston, Johnson Space Center is within the city limits of Houston, but once you drive out the front gate and go like 100 yards, it says entering Nassau Bay, and there's all these little towns around, and one of those little towns is called Webster. And they, I think they donated at least $3 million, if not $3.5 million. And then they raised the other $1.5 to $2 million through contributions. A lot of the contributions were made by former flight controllers, you know, who were very passionate about that room. I had one flight director. We have a Villanova flight director, by the way. His name is Brian Smith. But I talked to another flight director one time. I guess I had set up a tour for our company president. And so we arranged to have a flight director actually give him the tour. Mm-hmm. And he said something that every time I go on these tours, I learn something. And he said that he and some of the other flight directors, before they go on console in the active control room today, they go in. I'm not saying they do this every day or every week, but periodically they go in to the historic Mission Control Center and just like soak it up. It's like visiting a church to them. Sometimes it's like called a cathedral, you know? And I was surprised to hear that, but I'm, you know, just the way he told the story, I certainly believed him. So it's pretty cool when you think about it.
Once again, a very special thank you to Tom Sanzone for taking time out of his day, well, in this case, night, to be interviewed by me. Absolutely a joy every time I speak with Tom. The wonderful stories, the experiences, and the relationships that he talks about. It's always wonderful. And at least for me, I always feel as though that I'm there with him. Hopefully I'll see or talk to everyone next week. As always, see hope through all things. And sorry, Baratha the Hutt, I just stole that from you.